Now, I'm going to be talking with you in these evening lessons about some of the things out here in the world as we try to make our way through this changing world, things that divert us from the truth that God has shown us through Jesus Christ. And so I'm going to talk with you about a series of isms. We'll define each one of them each evening: intellectualism, subjectivism, materialism, humanism. All of those are words that we encounter, but they also are systems of thought that are quite enticing to young people and to the others of us, and that draw us away, it seems to me, from the very powerful truth that is present in God's directions given to us through Jesus Christ. This evening I'm going to explore with you just a little while the concept of intellectualism, which is a more general concept than the other things that I'll be talking with you about. I like Webster's Dictionary of Intellectualism partly because he begins out Definition 1, intellectual power, intellectuality. I never have figured out how you can define a word by saying it means what the word is. But more enlightening, maybe, is the second definition, and that is the doctrine that knowledge is derived from pure reason. That is the understanding that all of the things that we know come to us just based on our own mental ability to reason and find those things out. That is, in fact, although we may not think of ourselves as intellectuals here this evening, that is a very pervasive thing about human thought. In 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, beginning at verse 17, the Apostle Paul wrote, "For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness. But unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent." Beginning in verse 23, the Apostle Paul says, "But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness." Actually, I think 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, outlines two paths that people take that divert us from grasping the truth that God has given us through Jesus Christ. One of them we're going to be talking about this evening, and that is, he says, some people miss the wisdom of God because they're looking for the wisdom of men, and to them, God's wisdom is foolishness. Some people fall off the cerebral side of finding God's truth, and they won't accept it because it's not intellectual enough. And he says, the Jews require a sign, and to them, the gospel is a stumbling block. I believe that really raises the issue of subjectivism that I'll be talking about one evening. Many people try to live life being guided by their own feelings. And what they want is, they want over and over again a kind of a private affirmation of truth. They want private leadings. The Jews wanted a miracle a minute in order to demonstrate what it was that God wanted them to do. And the simple gospel of Jesus Christ, he said, people would stumble over the gospel if that is what they were looking for. So, intellectualism has always been a problem. And it is good for us, in the beginning of my lesson this evening, I just have about three simple points I'm going to make this evening, and we'll nail those down as we go through this. But it is good to begin by acknowledging that intellectualism has always been a problem. You know, we think sometimes, oh, well, it is so hard to be a Christian today and to believe the Bible today because we know so much. Let me give you a clue, folks. People always have thought they knew so much. And we look back and think how ignorant people were a long time ago. And if the world goes on another 1,000 or so years, I can guarantee you people will look back and think how ignorant you are. And in every age, in every time, there have been intellectuals, and people have been enticed into living their life believing that man's reason was the only guide to finding truth. Colossians, the second chapter, is a wonderful exposition of the danger that we find in trusting human wisdom. For I would that you know what great conflict I have for you and for them in Laodicea and for as many as we've not seen my face in the flesh, that your hearts might be comforted, being knit together in love, and unto all riches and the full assurance of understanding, to the acknowledgement of the mystery of God and of the Father and of Christ, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And this I say, lest any man should beguile you with enticing words. The book of Colossians, in many ways, is just a book about the sufficiency, the all-sufficiency of Jesus Christ to answer every question. We need no more revelations. We need no more information. We need no higher learning, but Christ is all. And he says, I tell you all of this, lest someone come along and entice you, or as he says in verse 8, beginning in verse 8 of chapter 2, beware lest any man spoil or seduce you through philosophy, that is a love of wisdom, and vain deceit after the traditions of men, that is some body of accepted precepts, after the rudiments of the world. And Thayer's definition of that is primary and fundamental principles of any art, science, or discipline. And what I want to suggest to you folks is that there are lots of paths out here in the world that people will tell you to take in order to find understanding of how to live your life. And the Scriptures warn us that we not be seduced by some intellectual system, whether it's an art or a science. And you say, oh, well, now science is fact. No, science is the facts that we know today. And science is just as changeable as any other discipline. And if it is not after Christ, he said, it can beguile you and seduce you and lead you away to a misunderstanding of what life is all about. Now, we looked last night at Proverbs, the 30th chapter, and saw that what the augur said man's great desire should be is to remove me far from vanity and lies. That the temptation to believe lies and be seduced by intellectual systems has always been present in the world. We don't have to deal with anything that is different from what people always have dealt with. In New Testament days, the New Testament was written and the gospel was preached in a time that was just absolutely beset with philosophical debate and intellectualisms. So that the Apostle Paul, when he preached in Athens in Acts the 17th chapter, perceived that all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time with nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So you young folks, when you go away to college and you enter into the intellectual realm and you meet professors in some discipline, whether it be philosophy or sociology or science or whatever, and they seem so wise, and indeed, many times they are wise, and they are brilliant. You need to know that they are not new. that there have always been brilliant minds around. And if you want to read some brilliant philosophy, you don't have to read somebody that wrote 2 years ago. Go back and read Plato. And read Aristotle, which is exactly what was going on in New Testament days. So, let's just acknowledge then, in the beginning, that the intellectual temptation has always been there. There have always been people offering alternatives to what God says. Now, there's nothing wrong with intellect. And there's nothing wrong with learning. There's certainly nothing wrong with reasoning. Science is fine. Science uses deductive reasoning, and that is logic. And the Scriptures tell us to use our reason. Come, let us reason together. We ought to be ready to give a reason for the hope that is within us. I used to think a long time ago that I was anti-intellectual. But I actually am not anti-intellectual at all. We need to use our minds and use our intellect. And you young folks, there is absolutely no danger, I think, whatsoever in studying a hard empirical science where you go in and you use your mind and you look at nature and try to understand it and see what God has done. And actually, in the academy, there are certain fields that I believe a Christian can enter without any fear. And most of the hard sciences are like that. You can be a physicist, or you can be a chemist, you can be a doctor. There are many areas where what people do is they simply use their minds to study God's creation. That is just fine. Now, you won't find any real answers to what life is all about. You won't find answers to the questions that Brother Bowman posed in his lesson last night. And that is, where did we come from, and what's going to happen to us when we die, and why are we here? Those are questions that science doesn't answer. I'm not going to talk with you about this issue this evening, but it is quite interesting that there are two modern ways in which reason and intellectualism goes, one of which is to study things empirically, to study with the scientific method and try to understand what it is that exists. There are other academic areas that are highly theoretical and very speculative. Actually, science itself took a turn in the late 19th century. And theoretical science came to dominate many fields of science rather than research empirical science. That was a very basic change. Many of the preachers in the late 19th century would call that science falsely so-called. Actually, theoretical science has been profitable from a scientific point of view because it allowed thinking about and speculation about many subjects that couldn't be thought about otherwise. But it also tried to address and theorize about and guess about questions of origin, eternity, the nature of man, that cannot be answered. And you young folks, we'll pass on over this quickly. It's a subject I'd like to talk with you about in more detail at some point. But I will have to tell you that you need to recognize that that sort of human intellectual activity is very slippery. And it's always been present. People have always speculated about these things, and they've come up with ridiculous ideas. And what we tend to do, however, is we say, well, I know people used to be foolish, but now we know. No, now we do not know. Now we theorize and speculate and guess, just like human beings always have, because intellectualism finally does not give us answers to these everlasting questions. I guess my favorite passage in all of the Bible that reinforces this point that we're on, and that I'll finish with in just a moment, is that passage at the end of the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, where the writer of Ecclesiastes discards wisdom as a way of orienting ourselves to life. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I'm come of great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived also that this is vexation of spirit. I'll tell you what the writer of Ecclesiastes says. He says, I looked down every road that you can look down. And what I can tell you is, there are no answers out there. He says, I chased down madness and folly. I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I used to have a really eccentric philosopher friend who said crazy things to me all the time. And among the things that he said to me that I recall, you know, he asked me one day, just out of the blue, he said, Ed, do you know the difference between a man and a dog? And I thought about that. I actually got to think of several differences. Number of legs and tail and so on. But I said, no. I said, what's the difference? He said, the difference is a man knows he's going to die. Now, that is some difference. A dog is going to die. But a dog runs around all his life, wagging his tail. He doesn't know he's going to die. I know. And I have to think about that. And I wonder why I'm going to die. And I wonder what's going to happen to me. And I wonder why I'm here. And I wonder what it means. And nobody knows. He said, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. This same guy, I was talking to him one morning. We were drinking coffee. And just out of the blue, he said to me, he said, Ed, he said, I will tell you what I've decided. He said, I have decided that the only people who understand life are crazy people. And that sounded kind of crazy. But I will tell you what will give a little credence to that is if you'll just sit back and watch sane people for a while, you might think it is crazy people who understand. Well, where we are left then at the end of Ecclesiastes is point one, nobody knows. How can we know what we ought to do in life? Surely there is a wise man somewhere who knows the secret. But there he is. Just ask him tonight. No. Even he doesn't know. Last night he asked me. So, point number one, it's a point that you know, we all understand quite well, that whatever the values of intellectualism are and of our ability to reason, when you get to the ultimate questions of life, nobody knows the answers. And so, if we allow intellectualism to divert us and infatuate us, what it can do is it can take away from us an understanding of life that is available to us in the wisdom of God. And so, returning to 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, the Apostle Paul says, for after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. The Apostle Paul said, I will tell you, man in his wisdom has walked away from the wisdom that God has given to us. I've often thought about that passage and thought about the things that were available to men for many years after creation. I mean, you know, Adam was alive for a long time. So that there were people hundreds and hundreds of years that had become so wicked and evil and infatuated with their own abilities, they could have gone and talked to Adam. You know, when Abraham was alive, that Noah's son was still alive. That the evidence is all over the place out there. And what the Apostle Paul says is God has given us all kinds of things to show us the way and to show us who He is and to give us wisdom. And men just wouldn't have that. Above all, He's given us the creation. To look at the universe and see all of the things that God has done. I'm going to be talking about that in a little more depth in the course of my lessons in the evening this week. I love some of the questions that God asked Job in Job 38 and verse 5. Gird up thy loins like a man, for I'll demand of thee and answer thou of me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. I mean, you want wisdom? Look at the power of God. I'm going to show you some of the... Can't see much of that, can you? One of my graduate students sent me some Hubble telescope photographs not long ago. I mean, they are just absolutely magnificent to put that on the screen and take a look at the universe. That stretches for billions and billions of light years. I mean, the size of the universe is just absolutely incomprehensible to us. I don't know if you've ever been to Saudi Arabia. Wouldn't recommend it right at the moment. But in the middle of that desert, it's absolutely fantastic to look up at the sky. I've flown over it a few times too. And to look up at the sky that tends to just almost be like daylight with the stars. I can just see those old patriarchs sitting around looking up at that sky and pondering God. And they couldn't see any of it from what we see in the billions and billions of years. I mean, the power of God, folks, is out there. And God asked Job and his friends, shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? Are we intellectually going to be talking about what the world is all about in the face of what God has made? Yeah, we're still doing that. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal just a few months ago, May 21st, about the origin of the universe, universe's big events, and this sentence just struck me. Perhaps, wrote physicist Edward Tryon in 1973, our universe is just one of those things that might happen from time to time. His speculation became the basis for what is now the leading theory, well supported by astronomical observations of how the universe was born and evolved. So, you want to know the answers? This is a smart guy. I'm sure he got a lot of reasons for saying that. But is that the best we can do? It is just something that happens every now and then? Excuse me, I just don't think so. I mean, it takes a lot of faith to believe that. Now, what I want to tell you is there are lots of intellectual paths out there. But they'll divert you from a very powerful revelation that God has given us that tells us about who we are and what the world is all about. Real intellectualism is embracing the wisdom of God. Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. And my final point, really, that I want to leave you with this evening, and particularly you young people, is that a trust in God through Christ Jesus is not anti-intellectual. Nor is it unreasonable. It is, in fact, the most reasonable thing that you could possibly do. Let me take you quickly through another article that I read not long ago, May 11, 2002, in the New York Times. And I'll just have to confess now and repent. I do read the New York Times. That God, and it was entitled, So God is Really in the Details. And I just found this a fascinating kind of discussion of a conference that took place. And it does teach us that we need to not be intimidated by the intellectualisms of our times. This was the article, So God is Really in the Details, and it told of a conference that was held at Yale University and a speech delivered by an Oxford University theologian named Richard Swinburne, who I've met on occasions. And it said, thanks to the efforts of Mr. Swinburne and a handful of other nimble scholarly minds, religious belief no longer languishes in a state of philosophical disrepute. Now, actually, it hasn't been languishing too much anyhow. But deploying a range of sophisticated logical arguments developed over the last 25 years, Christian philosophers have revived faith as a subject of rigorous academic debate, steadily chipping away at the assumption, all but axiomatic in philosophy, since the Enlightenment, that belief in God is logically indefensible. And it is, I must say, refreshing that that kind of language would be spoken by a professor from Oxford at a Yale conference, saying that the time has come to recognize that a belief in God makes more sense than most of the ideas that are peddled out here by men who are philosophers. I'll tell you what he used in this speech. He used mathematical theory. He used probability theory. And I don't know much about mathematical theory, but I've talked with some of our mathematicians at Auburn about it. He used a theory proposed by a man named Thomas Bayes for determining with what degree of confidence we have in various possible conclusions based on a body of evidence available. There it is. I'm sure you'll recognize it. I looked it up on the web. And Bayes' theorem is used to forecast insurance and to forecast economic conditions. And it's used by gamblers, used in casinos. We actually, when I typed up Thomas Bayes' theorem on the web, I finally got a lot of information about what it was. But what I kept getting these casinos popping up, you know, and they're of course they pop up and they are hard to get rid of. I'm sure you know it's hard to get them off. In fact, I think before I got rid of them, I won $5,000. Only kidding for the tape. What Mr. Swinburne did is, he plugged stuff into this Bayes theory of probability about what was probable. And supplying pages of intricate technical argumentation to back up his claims, he wrote that many natural phenomena, including the universe itself, are, well, if not incontrovertible proof of God's handiwork, at least more probable if there is a God than if there is not. So, I will tell you what you have to do, young folks. You calculate the odds. People are selling lots of stuff out here. But finally, what you have to decide, is God a snake? Or a bird? Or an image? Or maybe a man is God, professing himself to be wise? I don't think so. Maybe God doesn't exist. Maybe the universe is just one of those things that happens from time to time. Or maybe, when we look up, we see the handiwork of God. And I want to tell you that there are just so many ways that you can bet your life. You can say, I'm going to be an atheist and believe that there is no God. And actually, these are the options. You can say, I'm going to be an atheist and believe that there's not a God. Or I'll be a theist and I'll believe in God. Or you might say, I'm an agnostic, and I'm just going to say, I don't know. Now, I want to suggest to you, really, that there are only two choices. Agnosticism is not really a choice. If you tell me, when I ask you, what is the meaning of the universe, if you tell me, I don't know. I just don't know. Well, I know you don't know. I don't know, either, if what you mean by that empirical, no. So you haven't told me anything to say, I don't know. But I will tell you what you have to do. Whether you know or not, you have to live your life. And you will live your life as if something were true. You will live your life as if it's just me and I'm just an animal like everybody else and there's nothing out there, or I'm going to follow some false idea. Or you live your life as if there's a God. The Bayesian odds are, according to Mr. Swinburne, 97% chance, and according to the formula, that there's a God. I think it's more like 100%, but 3% that there's not. 97% is pretty good. If I could give you a betting tip on 97%, sure that you would win. Some of you might lose your religion tonight. I hope not. But let me tell you, folks, that when you get out here in the world and people ridicule you and say, well, you're just following superstition, you are following an intellectual path that makes sense in a world that does not make sense. Well, a lot of Bible lessons, a lot of preaching in the Bible begins with these very propositions that we've talked about tonight. I will tell you, I don't know how many Bible passages and sermons in the New Testament begin with creation. And so you need to look out and see what God is and see what God has done. And man doesn't have any answers for that. And when the Apostle Paul preached from that motif in Acts the 17th chapter, he said, I will tell you two things that needs to tell you. Number one, if you understand who God is and that you do not know the way, but that God has given us direction, you need to come to Him, not telling Him what you're going to do, but asking Him what He would have you to do. God doesn't need anything from me, as if I could offer something to Him. But I come to Him, offering my service, and thanking Him for giving me direction in life. And second, if we understand that there is a God in heaven, and that He rules over all, and that He has given us directions, I'll tell you what just makes sense, young people, is you ought to try to find Him. And He has indeed shown us the way, that in Him we live and move and have our being. And if there is anything that the heavens teach us, it is that we need to not be diverted by man's vanities and enticements, but say, I want to seek the Lord and find Him. Well, we'll take a break for just a moment before Brother Bowman.